Innovation Ag is made on the lands of the Gunditjmara and Wurundjeri peoples. We acknowledge the traditional owners of country throughout Australia. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. Hello and welcome to Innovation Ag, brought to you by the Victoria Drought and Innovation Hub. I'm Kirsten Diprose. In this episode, we're bringing you the extended interview from Christine Pitt, the founder and managing director of Farmers to Founders. Christine was in episode 3, Finding Funding and Building Networks. We could only play part of her interview, but I really want to bring you the parts you didn't get to hear because Christine is both a great innovation thinker and doer. In her opinion, for innovation in agriculture to be successful, farmers need to be at the centre of it because they're the ones with all the problems. Wait, that came out wrong. Farmers are the problem holders. That's what she says. Basically, the ones on the ground who can identify the pain points. So this episode is all about how problem holders can either become their own problem solvers or be connected with other people, such as technologists or company founders, who can help find the solution. So if you're thinking about value adding or getting involved in developing a new technology for agriculture, you'll be hanging on to every word. And Farmers to Founders is itself a startup. So Christine is really putting her money where her mouth is. But I'll let her tell you the story of how it all started.
So Farmers to Founders is an idea that I had for quite a while. My previous role was as a general manager and CEO within the Meat and Livestock Australia business in the red meat industry. And we had run a number of programs that were really testing the hypothesis that I'm explaining to you that farmers can and want to be part of this process. Many of them, not all of them, but many of them have that kind of entrepreneurial drive or interest. And so we ran a couple of programs while I was still at Meat and Livestock Australia to test that hypothesis. And it really overwhelmed me. This response overwhelmed me with the enthusiasm that we were able to generate, both for that entrepreneurial journey that some of them go on and now with Farmers to Founders, but also the speed with which they want to really understand better the kinds of ag tech that they want to get onto their farms and understand what they need to do to build their own capability. So that was kind of the genesis of the idea. I left Meat and Livestock Australia in early 2018 and spoke to a few of my colleagues and peers and tested the idea. And then we started shopping it around all of the R&D corporations just to see if in that first instance we could get some sort of industry interest in this to help us kickstart the business. So we formed the company at the end of 2018 and in early 2019 we kicked off. We were also lucky enough to receive one of the early incubator support grants from the federal government. So that was really helpful in giving us that sort of financial base to really test our theories. And it's all history from there. We've grown quite substantially since that early 2019 launch.
Yeah, you really have. What are some of the initial projects that you helped bring to life?
So it's probably worth me explaining just briefly the kind of the two streams of work we now do in Farmers to Founders. This is how we started the business. So we've got a stream of work, which is really that entrepreneurial stream. We call that our venture creation or venture building stream. And we offer learning and development, but mainly through accelerator type programs or incubator type program services for there. And so our very first cohort that came into that was called our bootcamp program. We had 8 producers. It was only offered to producers who were interested in developing solutions. We wanted to see how many of them were out there and whether we could attract them and keep them interested and engaged in a program like that. And we were, we think, really successful. So we had a mixture of value-adding as well as ag tech businesses. So Farm Simple and Farm Services were 2 ag tech businesses. Also, we had Bitwise, Fiona Turner from Tasmania. We also had some value-adding businesses because we also believe very much that producers have an interest in developing new business opportunities for their own farming practice so that they can not only get closer to consumers, create more value, but capture some of that value back onto their farm. So a couple of the standouts value-adding businesses was Outback Lamb. So Fiona Abiard, who's a bit of a poster girl for us, so she's our lamb producer in New South Wales. We had some camel producers in Queensland called Q Camel, who have the only organic camel farm in the world. They were developing skincare products. So yeah, we had a really great selection from that very early stage, developing app solutions to help farmers manage machinery or make better decisions, right through to Bitwise, which is a much more sort of sophisticated technology in the wine industry. So there were lots of different examples. So I couldn't pick a favorite. I love all the children.
I'll pick one for you. I love the camel story. Who would have thought that you could use camel milk to make soap and it would be so successful?
Exactly. Yeah. And that was a really interesting business to work with. And in fact, we're still working with them now. So they've had lots of ups and downs, which startups do on their journey. Some really good wins and then some really hard lessons when they probably rushed into an export strategy a little bit too soon. But that's the typical journey of a startup. And just this last year, we've launched a masterclass series in collaboration with a venture capital and equity crowdfunding platform and ran a masterclass of the whole equity crowdfunding model. And QCamel were one of our guinea pigs, our pilot companies in that. We're definitely working with startups to, first of all, assess whether they've even got a growth mindset, whether they actually are looking at growing their business in some way that's different to an SME. When businesses start, it's not always clear what direction they're going to go in. And sometimes the founders themselves, some have a very clear view that they're on a fast growth trajectory, and that's what we would describe as a startup journey, versus others are really just looking for a nice small business that will bring a little bit of extra income or create opportunities for their children or help them serve a defined local community, you know, whether it's with healthy food or whatever. And so we try and really understand what the goal of that founder is. And our business is mainly directed towards the first group, the startup group, but we're also quite happy to work with what will eventually become a small to medium-sized enterprise, an SME, who's probably not going to grow fast and probably at best will only be able to approach a debt financing model once they've got something that's obvious to hold up as for the risk debt finance is being acquired for. So I think debt financing typically from banks in agriculture has very much required those really obvious assets that can be liquidated if everything turns to custard. And banks, this is not in their wheelhouse generally or hasn't been looking at financing startups because that's on a promise, that's on a dream rather than a clear physical asset that they can see and think about, okay, if this doesn't go well, I'm managing my risk here. Whereas investors in startups have a very different perspective on what they're looking for. They're definitely looking for much greater returns than a debt finance interest rate would require, but they also understand that only a very small percentage of the investments that they make are going to deliver that very high return, and that will take account of all the risk of the ones that don't go anywhere, that go the other way, go down the gurgler, as it were. And so it's a very different investment model.
So if I'm a producer wanting to do something quite different with my produce, whether that be wheat or milk or anything else, where's a good place to start? You've got this great idea. You're really passionate about it. How do you know where to go for funding for that next step?
Well, funding's probably not the first thing you need, particularly if you're talking about a product, because if you're a farmer and you're looking at adding value to your existing agricultural offtake, you don't need a lot of money to get started. What you need is to understand what's your customer segment, what's your market? Does anyone care about what you care about? And so that's the sort of thing when we have producers come into our programs that are around that kind of innovation, which is a product innovation. That's the first thing that we work on. We actually have an early stage program we call our Hatch program, where they're trying to hatch their idea. But what we're really trying to get them to do is to validate their idea and to work out who cares about this. So typically anyone who comes as an entrepreneur is already passionate about their idea because they're trying to solve their own personal problem usually. So either they're somebody who's got dietary issues or they've got a kid who's a fussy eater, or in the case of some producers, they've got some ugly produce that they're trying to get rid of at a price that's not going to send them broke. And so they're trying to solve their own problem first, which is fantastic because they understand that. What we then get them to do and what we would encourage anyone who's thinking about, should I do this as a business idea, is does anyone else have this problem? Can you actually find someone or explore it customer segment or a consumer segment that shares the same passion or need as you. And there are many different ways, far too many, that we've got time to talk about today in terms of how you would validate your idea. So we definitely would encourage any producer with that kind of idea, get onto the Farmers to Founders website and book a call with us and we can take you through that process. If it's a tech idea, which is a bit different, once again, typically the farmers who have a tech bent to them, and many of them do, and there's no age-specific entrepreneur profile here, they can be of any age or any persuasion, they are typically already fiddling with their technology, if that makes sense. They're out in the shed building things, taping things together, taking a technology that doesn't quite work for them, dismantling it and re-putting it together in a different iteration. So they are already playing with their idea, if that makes sense. And once again, if all they want to do is solve their own problem, that's fantastic. And there are things they can do. But if they really want to turn this into a business, it's the same thing. First of all, validate that this problem is real for someone else other than yourself and get out there and do customer interviews, get to trade shows, go to demo sites, whatever. Just start talking to the people who might be your future customers to make sure that the problem exists.
How many customers do you need to talk to? How many trade shows do you need to go to know you're onto something?
It's a really good question and there's no simple answer. In our early stage program, we like, as a minimum, we would hope that in a 6-week program that they will have done 30 to 50 customer interviews, but that might be in a couple of different segments. So it's not just the same interview 30 times, if that makes sense. We get them to do it in sort of groups of 5 interviews and then we have a process that they go through that they get insights. They might switch and pivot. They might just try and get further validation. So at some point, there may be around 15 to 20 in a particular customer segment or a particular problem area, you start to feel a really strong sense that you are onto something or there's a real problem there, but it's a bit different to what you thought about and you need to switch your idea or adapt your idea or even pivot your entire idea. You know, you can start to get that relatively simply through about 15 to 20, but they've got to be properly constructed interviews and thought through and not surveys and not would you like to buy this type of, that's not an interview. So not yes, no, would you like my, do you like my idea? It's really trying to understand the problem. So as long as they're high quality interviews, you can start to get confidence around 15 to 20. But as I said, we encourage far more than that. But we're also doing a few other things now. So we've recently developed a digital platform, which we call the Tech Farm Muster, bit of a quirky name, I know, Farmers to Founders Tech Farm Muster. And that's actually a digital platform. And what we're doing there is building up a really, really significant database or library, if you like, of problem statements from real farmers. And so if a tech company comes to us and they say, we're not quite sure what's going on here, they will have that opportunity to be able to get access to some really well thought through problem statements that have been curated for them that are in the kind of space that they think. So most tech solution providers think they're solving a problem. So we'll start to help them understand what do these problems really look like before you get too excited about it. But you can't beat that one-on-one discussion with real customers.
So say you've done your customer validation, you're confident that it is not just, to quote you, falling in love with your own idea, essentially. Where do you go then to actually get the money to make it happen?
Well, you're a bit focused on the money here, Kirsten.
That's what people want to know, right?
I think people don't understand that there's so much you can do and you should do before you start looking at the big dollars that you're either going to find yourself or you're going to have to go out to the investment community. The problem lies when people do or have access to money that's, you know, family, friends and fools, as we talk about it, or their own money, or they do make a huge risky decision and they do it too early before they've got some reason to believe that this is a viable option. So I'm going to keep resisting your question just for a bit and then I'm going to come back to it. We certainly use what we call the lean startup methodology when we're working with startups. And what lean startup is, to fail fast, frugally. So to go as far as you can go with as little money as possible is really what underpins the lean startup methodology. It's a well-proven methodology. It's used by startups all around the world. And in the end, it's the thing that probably is going to make the biggest difference to future success or otherwise. And it certainly helps startup founders avoid that early stage exuberance if they happen to have access to funds. And then they just may as well dig a hole by a boat, I always say, rather than put it into this startup. And so we try and get the startup to go as far as they can using that methodology. Now, we say build a prototype for no more than $50. Okay, $50. Most people can get $50 together. And so in that very early stage, we're asking them to build prototypes that they can put in front of customers. And then there's a whole range of experiments that they can do to prove to themselves and future investors that customers are likely to care about their solution. And so there's lots of things you can do with very small amounts of money. Now, 50 is probably a bit extreme, but certainly $1,000 or even the $10,000 that we provide for some of our startup programs, that's enough to really start you off on the journey. And then it really depends on what kind of product and how much it costs you to build that prototype. The ones where this probably doesn't work is hardware, big machinery type solutions. That's really where you need to get serious money, like $100,000 or more, to build even that very first stage prototype. And typically we're looking for that non-dilutive funding at that stage. So whether it's government grants, industry support, maybe marshalling your own family and friends at that level would be what you would need to do. Whereas a food product or a SaaS product or an app, a software product, you can develop that without seeking very much external funding at all. And so it's only really when you're getting to that scale-up stage that you really need to go out to the investment community, that first scale-up. So you're trying to get some level of market traction, and investors won't invest in you unless you've got some evidence of customer traction. So that's what you've got to put your effort into with as little money as possible. But then you're open to the investment community. So to answer your question more directly, that's when we would be starting to get our startups, when we think they're at that stage, we're starting to get them ready to approach the investment community. So we give them lots of opportunities to meet investors of all different types. We really encourage them to start doing research in across the investment community with support and starting to get to know the investor personally, and that investor knows them. If you're going to go for any kind of serious investment other than on an equity crowdfunding platform, you're going to spend 6 to 9 months before you even ask for money. And so there's a lot that you've got to do as a startup to get ready for that investment, but you've also got to get yourself out there. So it's the same kind of networking that you need to do with investors as you would with customers or any other kind of partners. And so getting yourself into the environment where investors hang out, we create those opportunities, but there are lots of opportunities. So putting yourself into pitch competitions, even if you're not ready for a pitch, if that makes sense, you're not looking for the money yet.
You mentioned at the very start government funding. When is government funding useful, do you think? And where are some good places to find some grants?
Definitely, there are a number of different grant alert services that you should get yourself onto. So there's Grant Connect, there's the Community Grants Hub, there's a number of different places. It just comes into your regular updates, sometimes more than once a day, I'm finding at the moment. But yeah, so you just get yourself alerted to any of the government grants. There's a directory of government grants for federal government grants. You can go onto business.gov and you can do keyword searches, or you can scroll through all of the open grants just to see what might be available. If you've got a specific industry solution, you might also look at the R&D corporations. So as you probably your listeners know, that all of the agricultural commodity sectors in Australia have an R&D corporation that looks after them. So I would definitely be looking at both. That's a good place to also find events to go to. So I'd go onto their websites to have a look there. Each state government also has different programs or different grants. So in New South Wales at the moment, there's what's called the MVP, Minimum Viable Product Grant, which you can apply for if you're building typically a technology solution and you're looking for support, and they've just increased the size of those grants. You need to look more broadly than just agriculture. So any government department that's in agriculture, food, industry development, regional and economic development would probably have some form of grant program open at any point in time.
When is a good time in your development as a startup founder potentially? Is it good to try and get some of these grants? Is it more early on?
Definitely early on. We are applying for grants regularly as a startup ourselves. So it's really good seed funding at that stage when you're not either looking for an equity-based investor or you're not ready for it. And you're looking at something, as I said, if you've got that sort of $100,000 you're looking for, $150,000, $200,000 that you're looking for, no investor's going to invest that sort of money. That's too small an amount. That's where government grants can be really helpful. And they're typically at that building your first prototype or getting your first hire in terms of a new staff member, a new technical capability or marketing or whatever it might be. So I would definitely be looking for either government or industry grants, and industry grants in agriculture are primarily through the R&D corporations. I would definitely be looking there because they don't take equity in your business. They'll typically be around the kind of amount of money at that very early stage that you're looking for. That's the positive side. The negative side is if you get obsessed with chasing grants, you'll get distracted from your business, and that ultimately could have a negative impact on your future growth and the development of your business. So it's really important when you're looking at grants to make sure that the objectives of the grant are, as far as possible, consistent with your strategic objectives. Just don't say, oh, there's some money and it's vaguely in the area that I'm doing, so I'll apply for that grant, because it can take you completely off track. And there are huge, what I would call, transaction costs related to looking at grants. The amount of time you spend putting in a grant application, and then if you're successful, and there's a very low success rate, unfortunately, but if you are successful, which is fantastic, it's very exciting. However, there are a lot of reporting and other kinds of costs associated with managing that grant. And so you really need to think deeply about that and think about, is this the right direction for us? Is this aligned to what we're trying to achieve? And do we actually have the resources available to both apply for the grant and or manage it? You can outsource that. So there are people around who provide a service in both writing your grant and then managing it, but they take a cut. They charge you a fee, which is not a bad thing. That's a good thing. It can stop you being distracted, but you've just got to factor that in when you're thinking about, is that the right step for me? And then I think the only other thing I would say about government grants, and we're pretty lucky in Australia, we have some really good government grants and quite a lot of them. They can become a bit disruptive from a political point of view. So grants come and go depending on the flavour of the day. But also, if your business model, as you're building a startup, you're building a business model, which means you've got a viable way of sustaining this business into the future. If you become so reliant on grants, then I have to tell you that is not a viable business model, because it's too volatile, too unpredictable, and too onerous. So you've got to get revenue as soon as you can from real customers.
There are some options from some of the big companies as well. Woolworths and Coles have started doing grants, I've seen, for various farming innovations. Are there some options out there that are really good?
They are. I mean, I think they're very competitive. So as I said, the success rate of grants, whether it be corporate, government, industry, are low. And so that's just something to factor in. So I'm not discounting grants. And they're all good, but they're all difficult to get. But I think the advantage when you're getting a grant from a corporate partner, like a big retailer, or it could be a food manufacturer or whatever it might be, that you're actually also building a potential customer relationship at the same time, or a channel partner relationship. So I think that's a real positive when it comes to getting involved in corporate accelerators. For example, we do run, through our food futures business, we do run corporate accelerator programs. And when you're first looking at recruiting startups into those sorts of programs, they get a bit nervous because they say, oh, isn't this big corporate that's just going to swallow us up, steal our ideas or whatever? And obviously there might be examples of that. Fortunately, I haven't worked with any corporates that do that sort of thing. But yeah, so you've got to be a little bit open-minded, I think, as a startup, in terms of if you are seeking investment, whether it's a grant type investment or an actual equity investment, you've got to really understand what that partner, that investor, in whatever context they're investing in you, is also trying to achieve. And once again, choose your partners wisely. It's like any partnership, an investor or a grant company, they have their objectives they're trying to achieve. Does that align with yours? If it does, sure, it's something worth pursuing.
You mentioned that venture is not often really an option, certainly not at the early stages. There are some really great companies that were startups, and they probably still are startups, but they're further down on that track, that have venture backing.
Yeah, there are always exceptions. And certainly, once again, we're lucky in Australia to have Main Sequence as one of the venture capital firms here in Australia. And as you would know, that is a venture capital firm that was formed in a partnership with CSIRO. So originally it was looking at specifically research outcomes that were being developed within the CSIRO research capability, and then looking at giving them that real kickstart to get out into V2 Foods came through that same model as well. So CSIRO have this venture studio, venture creation model, where Main Sequence was really able to step in probably earlier than you would typically expect a VC. So the principals of Main Sequence are a very experienced VC investors in their own right. but they were certainly given a kickstart through some government investment in that vehicle as well. So they could probably get in a bit earlier than your typical VC would normally have come in. I think that's changing now. There are now also some specialist VC firms in the ag tech space. Tenacious Ventures is a good example. Artesian does a lot of early stage investments as well, and they have a number of different models which will put small amounts of money into very early stage businesses. So I'm not saying the VC community is a total no-no to you, but just typically the mainstream VC firms are looking for later stage, a bit later stage than what some of the very, very early startups are at. But as I said, there's nothing stopping you as a startup talking to VCs, even when you're way, way, way too early and you're not even ready yourself to decide what you want to do when it comes to investment. But you should be starting to build that network very early. So get yourself out there, get yourself known, practice your pitching, go on LinkedIn to any VC firm that you can see might be interested in. Understand, because VCs are part of your network, as are all other investors, understand what they're looking for, understand what their investment thesis is or their investment portfolio looks like, so that you can start to see, would you be a fit for them? And just as importantly, would they be a fit for you? Because you're getting married when you get invested in by a VC. It's not something you jump into without going into a lot of due diligence on both sides.
I think that's a really great point. The VCs obviously have the money. You want a good one that has the expertise in your area. They're ideally led by general partners who really know a lot about how to push a startup forward, as well as bring in the money from investors.
Like any relationship, if you only go in it for the money, it's not really going to be a very fulfilling one, as much as the money seems attractive at the time. So yeah, I think that's a really good point. As I said, you're looking for a VC partner whose investment thesis matches your own. So if you're really looking at sustainability and making an impact, you want to be talking to VCs, not just because they're going to be attracted to you, but also because you know that they're not going to steer you in a direction that's away from your core purpose or your core values.
But unlike marriage, you can have more than one VC at a time.
Yeah, there's an interpretation of what marriage is too, I guess. So you definitely would normally have one VC at a time. So very often you'll have a lead VC, but they're often also interested in bringing other VCs. There's a lot of VCs that won't go into a deal by themselves. They'll only go in if there's at least two others. So that's safety in numbers, spreading the risk, all of that kind of stuff.
Another important consideration for a founder is when to make that leap from side hustle to working full-time on your startup. And then there's the issue of work-life balance.
I'm not the best person to ask that because I'm not very good at it myself. So definitely it is a big issue. And whether your startup is your side hustle and you're going to continue for the foreseeable future, you have to and need to continue with your day job, as it were, and then you're doing your startup on the side, versus do you have the capacity to make the leap and go into your startup full time? So that's a challenge that many of our startups, they're often at that cusp of trying to make that decision and trying to work out, is this the right time? And some kind of put the blindfold on and jump, and others are very cautious and probably are never going to jump. But at some point in time, if you're going to make your startup a real success, there has to be full-time commitment. It doesn't necessarily have to be you, but you have to have a core team that has that full-time commitment. This is where the concept of co-founders can become really helpful. And so if you're a sole founder, we definitely encourage you to have a think about, is this the time to bring in a co-founder, somebody who can not only complement your skill set, you don't want someone who's exactly like you necessarily, but also take some of that load off you and some of that pressure off you. And obviously, if you're bringing in someone as a co-founder, you're starting to share your business with them, and they might be also willing to come in and not necessarily require a big salary or anything like that if they're going to put their sweat equity into the business as well. So yeah, there are lots of different techniques. We definitely suggest that startup founders, like everyone else, the whole mental health issue with entrepreneurs is becoming quite well documented now globally, and thinking about and making sure that you're finding at least some degree of balance. It's not the same as if you've got a corporate job and you can switch it off at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock. It doesn't work like that. Having that understanding of what it's like to be an entrepreneur and a founder is really important, so that your expectations match the reality. But then thinking about ways of sharing that load and just getting some breathing space, you definitely have to be able to do that, which might mean that your startup doesn't grow quite as quickly as you'd hoped or you thought it was going to, or it might mean that you give up some equity sooner through that idea of having some co-founders to share the load with you.
Sorry to link it back to money, but, you know, making that leap often is reliant on money, whether it's having that equity or having some actual income coming in enough to feel like you can make a leap, even if yourself, you're only taking a 30 grand salary, you know, it's at least it's something.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend as soon as possible, even quite early, that founders do pay themselves at least some form of salary. It might be, as you say, under the market rate. It will definitely be under the market rate if you've come from a corporate job, significantly under that rate. But try and give yourself at least the basic minimum wage, which I think is about $57,000 in Australia or something like that. Yeah, that should be a goal that you can get yourself to as quickly as possible. Because if you can't, or if it's a long time coming, then you're probably not working on a viable business model anyway. And so founders who start employing others and still not paying themselves anything, that's probably not, I'm not saying it's an absolutely bad idea, but it's probably not a terrifically good idea either. So try and get your business to the point. And once again, it's through customer acquisition and revenue. If you can, it might be that you've been able to pay yourself something through operating costs of a government grant, for example. So most government grants allow you to pay some salaries or some percentage of salaries, not lavish ones, at least give yourself something. It's too hard otherwise, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Christine, thank you so much. I think we can leave it there. Is there anything else you would like to add?
No, I think it's been a great conversation, Kirsten. We're really passionate about this area of farmers to founders. As I said, helping farmers think about solving problems for themselves and then building businesses out of their ideas, but also on the adoption side of technology, helping farmers and technology companies come closer together and really help them understand each other's perspective so that relationship can be much stronger and Australia's agricultural sector will be stronger and better for it if we can get more great technologies helping our farmers, whether it's developed by a farmer or by a tech company in the end, it may not matter, but helping our farmers really continue to play that really important role in not only our own economy, but also in supplying really healthy food to a wide range of consumers outside of Australia as well in a sustainable way.
And that's it for our extended interview with Christine Pitt, the founder and managing director of Farmers to Founders. Thank you, Christine, for joining us. If you liked this episode, I recommend listening to episode 3 in the Innovation Ag series. It's called Finding Funding and Building Networks. This podcast is brought to you by the Victoria Drought and Innovation Hub, a partnership of 4 universities, 5 farming systems groups, and Agriculture Victoria. Make sure you check out our website to see what events and programs we're running. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend. Innovation Ag is funded by the Australian Government. I'm Kirsten Diprose. Thank you for listening. I'll catch you next time.